From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, journalist and author Jason Kirsten will join us to talk about his new book, The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. The book profiles Art Williams Jr., who printed millions of dollars of phony money and managed to counterfeit the U.S. Treasury-issued 1996 new note, which was said to be the most secure bill ever made. The compelling story of Art Williams is of a criminal mastermind who ultimately was thwarted in his criminal career because of love for a father who had abandoned him. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Author and journalist Jason Kirsten first wrote about master counterfeiter Art Williams Jr. in Rolling Stone magazine and then went on to tell the story of Williams' life and criminal career in his recently published book, The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. Master counterfeiters are rare, but Williams was clearly one of the best at his criminal craft, and he printed off literally millions of dollars worth of fake bills, including a reproduction of the 1996 Treasury Department's so-called new note, said to be at the time the most secure bill ever created. Kirsten manages to weave in a history of counterfeiting, as well as a detailed picture of how a young man from the impoverished streets of Chicago, who began a life of crime, breaking parking meters, stealing cars, and robbing drug dealers, found his way to being perhaps America's most successful counterfeiter. And the story of Art Williams is also a tale of a man hungry for the love of a father who abandoned him and ultimately betrayed him. In addition to Rolling Stone, Jason Kirsten has written for Men's Journal and Maxim and is the author of The Journal of the Dead. He now lives in New York City but grew up partially here in Northern California in Marin County, and he joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
He grew up listening to me and thought maybe one day I'll be on the program, and here you are, huh? And I got to tell you, he came in here and handed me a $100 bill that is the work of this, I don't know what you got to call him a craftsman, really, or an artist.
A criminal craftsman is what
criminal
I like
craftsman.
To say.
Yeah, it's awfully good looking at this bill. And lots of people have looked at his bills and got very excited, and especially many of the criminals, as you write about in the book, suddenly thought, wow, here I can spend these things. There's a kind of glow that you write about that people feel when they see this money.
Yeah, the glow is a term that Art invented, and that describes the look that took place in people's faces when they saw these bills and realizes that he could make as many as he wanted. And really the glow is just kind of a reflection of people's own greed and their dreams.
Well, a lot of that comes through here, his own dreams and his glow. It's a very personal story. It's a story that's framed really with his father, because early on his father abandoned the family, and you don't know how much is nature and how much is nurture growing up in public housing and becoming a criminal, but certainly his father stayed in his mind his whole life. And as you frame the story, as I indicated, not to ruin the plot here because it is like a novel, wanting his father proves to be his undoing, or wanting to reunite with his father. Let's talk about his father first. His father was actually not – his name was Luciano, like Lucky Luciano.
Yeah, yeah. His father grew up in Lamont, Illinois, which is outside Chicago. And he was his father had a tough childhood himself.
And was a crook.
His father was a paper hanger. He would very often he'd take the family on the road, and he would open a checking account and then go to stores, go shopping at a department store, buy a bunch of goods and return them for cash, and then flee town before people got onto him. Back in the the 60s when he'd do this, in the early 70s, you could get away with that pretty easily. And so from the beginning, Art had nature versus nurture. There was both right there. His dad had a mistress, and eventually he went with her, and he left the whole family. And they wound up in the Bridgeport Homes, which is a housing project in the south side of Chicago in Bridgeport. And, shortly after that, his mom was diagnosed with bipolar schizophrenia. And she was pretty much out of commission during his teenage years growing up. So he had a really, really tough childhood.
And ran with the gangs and did all this criminal activity and became a pretty tough character, I mean, by any standards. He was beating up drug dealers,
right.
Rolling drug dealers.
Right. Well, there's an old saying from Bridgeport. I think it was one of the first mayors, Henry Carter Harrison, which called Bridgeport a place where boys are either hellions or early candidates for the last rites of the church. And in the 80s and 90s, when Art was growing up in Bridgeport, it really hadn't changed that much.
Well, it's almost Dickensian in American sense. But he was a good student. He had promise, artistic talent, could have worked in construction. In fact, did some work in construction, but took that path away from all that.
Yeah, I mean, and this is really the tragedy of Art's life. You know, when he was a kid, he skipped two grades. During all the instability between his parents, the one thing, they were moving around a lot, and the one thing that he held on to was his academics. And he was a straight-A student all the way up until about his freshman year in high school, when he ended up in a really bad high school. And he decided that academics no longer interested him, and he got involved in the gang and the projects. And but this was a brilliant little kid. He was like a little prodigy.
And you can tell that he opened up so much detail of his life with really astute memory to you. I mean, in terms of the details and all. I'm wondering, to what extent do you find everything he told you credible?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, that from the very beginning, because he was sort of a con artist. And you know, I'm writing a book and he's conning me. And you know, it's funny. He did lie to me about certain things, but they weren't the things that you would expect a con artist. He was still counterfeiting when I began working on the book, and even the Rolling Stone article, he told me he had quit. And that was really the biggest lie he ever told me, that I'm still an active criminal. And the funny thing is when I would research these other stories and cross reference with his friends and other sources, I would find that all this stuff he told me was true. And I would use police reports, you know, court documents. I interviewed police officers who knew him. And in some cases, Art would downplay things. And I would be astonished to say, well, Art, why didn't you tell me this about this story? And I was kind of embarrassed about that. So I really didn't feel conned by him at all.
Well, you give a very multidimensional portrait. I mean, he comes off as not only a con man and a criminal with larceny in his heart, but probably a pretty charming guy, I imagine. And you describe him as very good looking.
Yeah, he is a good looking guy. And, you know, he's got these nice blue eyes physically. He's always taking care of his body. I mean, growing up in the gangland, he kind of had to be in shape. And all the women in his life, that would be one of the first of two things they would say. They'd say, well, I was attracted to him, for one, because he was very, very good looking, and two, he was very smart.
And there's all this panoply of characters in his life. I mean, you know, criminal characters, underworld characters, but also Chinese mafia and Russian mafia. I mean, it's amazing for a guy who is in this housing development world of Chicago to have made this many inroads into really major crime.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago is really just sort of the criminal capital. I mean, if you're a crime writer, there's so much going on there. And, you know, with the Outfit and all the other organized crime groups.
The Outfit being the mafia group.
Yes, which is, you know, traditionally the most powerful one. And a lot of them were from Bridgeport. You know, just a few blocks away, it might as well have been 100 miles. You know, you had kids that Art became friends with at the local basketball courts whose, you know, fathers were really running criminal empires. And, you know, once he got into auto theft, then he hooked up with the Chinese who were big into that. And there's so many relationships between these different groups. And one of the most fascinating things doing this book was Art describing all these interrelationships and really painting what I thought was a very vivid portrait of Chicago's criminal underworld.
Talking to Jason Kirsten, his new book is The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. And you as a journalist, I've got to ask you, do you find, I mean, there's kind of fascination with this whole subterranean world and underworld life that you're writing about, isn't there?
Absolutely. I certainly wouldn't want to be part of it.
Although I did read an interview you did where you said you might have been tempted at one time to do a little counterfeiting because you learned so much about the art of it. Yeah.
Right. There's been times when, you know, I've thought, boy, I probably know more about how he produced these than anybody.
You could read this book almost as a manual. I hate to say it, but you know.
You really think so?
Well, not entirely.
Because I didn't. I intentionally tried not to do that because I could have gotten much more into the intricacies of exactly how he did it. Because there's many steps to counterfeiting, but I didn't want it to be a manual. I didn't want some kid in Idaho suddenly thinking that he could go off and do this.
Well, I think that's responsible of you, and because it could, there are ways at least to get into the profession here. I think if you really were so inclined or so disposed, but. He got into it by a guy named Da Vinci. It's interesting because we just had a caller. We did a segment on Honduras who called from Honduras and gave the name Da Vinci. That was what he was known as. He was a guy who drove a Cadillac and was a beau of art's mother. And, you know, he was a mysterious figure until art learned that this is what he was doing. He was counterfeiting. That's who he, that was his mentor. That was his father figure, really.
Yeah. Art was, he got heavily into the street crime. And then when he was 16, he got his girlfriend pregnant. And suddenly he realized he was going to have to, really support a family. And he started stealing cars more and more. And he, quickly was on a path that was going to wind up in prison or dead. And his mom's boyfriend, this sort of bohemian figure who would hang out at the diner across the street from the projects where she works, was watching him. And he knew that Art was a smart kid. And he knew all the stories about how well he did at school. And then he starts seeing Art get into trouble and, going into juvenile hall and suddenly having a kid to support. And he decides to take Art under his wing and show him the craft of counterfeiting. And Art always knew that he did something for money. And in Bridgeport, you don't really ask questions. He was in construction and Art knew that probably wasn't true, but he wasn't about to pry.
Or waste management like Tony Soprano.
Exactly. And then so Da Vinci takes Art into his counterfeiting lair, and Art suddenly realized this is what he does, and Art was very excited, of course.
And what an elaborate operation it was, too. And then, I'm not going to give things away here, but you get into the whole nature of counterfeiting, even into the history of what you call the second oldest profession. I never would have thought of Diogenes with counterfeiting, but there you are.
Yeah, the Diogenes. Well, there are two Diogenes, Diogenes of Sinope started out as a counterfeiter. And it's interesting, this has been a legacy crime from the beginning because Diogenes was exiled from the city of Sinope, which is on the Turkish coast. He was exiled along with an old man who was his father, who also worked in the local bank. And so it was a very short route from that to counterfeiting. And Diogenes, he went on to become a great philosopher, of course. And that's just fascinating me that from the very beginning when I looked into the history of this crime, there's a master and an apprentice, and it gets passed down from generation to generation. And
like so many crafts.
Yeah, like many. I mean, really, it is. Yeah. It's a criminal craft. It's not something you could teach yourself, but it'd be very difficult. You'd be learning how to operate machinery, learning some of the theories and principles behind advanced printing techniques, and something somebody needs to show you.
There's an aesthetics to it, though, as you point out, and there's also the whole kind of side history of the Secret Service and their role in the American tracking down of counterfeit work. The zealotry of the Secret Service you certainly convey here in your book, and also the fact that it was tied to presidential protection, and the two were inseparable.
Right. Well, the Secret Service originated solely fighting counterfeiters, and it was really the last order that Abraham Lincoln gave on the day that he died, before he was assassinated, because at that time, right after the Civil War, as much as a third of all U.S. currency was
just flooded,
was counterfeit,
yeah.
And the country was up to its ears in war debt, and they said we got to do something to shut this thing down so our money is good again. And so they got a bunch of Civil War spies and Pinkertons together and went out and infiltrated these gangs and groups of counterfeiters. They were often like little covens of people who were working together, stealing plates and selling them to each other. And they were extremely successful at this. And that became a formalized group, the United States Secret Service. And, 40 years later, it was only $1 out of every 100,000 that was counterfeit. And a tremendous change when you think at one time, a third of the money was fake. So this organization was so good that when McKinley was assassinated and they decided we need somebody to protect the president, they made the Secret Service take on this new mission. Their joint mission now is really those two things, protect the currency, protect the president.
Well, the way to protect the currency also was this new bill that I mentioned in the introduction, Treasury Department issued in 1996, the new note, the most secure bill ever made. And there's Art Williams again.
Yeah. Yeah. Most people remember back in 1996 when, you know, suddenly they started looking at their money. It was, started with a $100 bill. And there was this big Benjamin Franklin, a guy with a big head, Big Head Ben, they called him. And there were all these new things in the currency, like color shifting ink and a watermark and a security strip, all these little secret devices buried in the bill that was designed to thwart really an increase in digital counterfeiting, most of it. And, you know, to the man who could actually come up with a convincing counterfeit, that, you know, there was the great prize. And Art had been counterfeiting for years before that. And when he saw this bill, it was a challenge to him. He said, whoever can get all these security features into their version of this bill, the payoff could be huge. And he made it his sort of holy grail quest.
Talking with Jason Kirsten, who has authored a book called The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. And he'll be at Book Passage this Saturday at 7 p.m. in Corte Madera, California. When they started printing money, Art and well, his inamorata, his wife, and so forth. I mean, they would go on these sprees. You write about these sprees. And they go on the road. They, in fact, talked about his retirement in reverse, just spending money everywhere, going to malls. And, I mean, it was a whole process that you write about that they had for spending this money and getting away with it. But they also described it as almost spiritual.
Yeah, this was one of the more fun and fantasy elements of that lifestyle. Art... his bills got so good that he really fell in love with his money, which was something Da Vinci had warned him never to do, never go on spending sprees with your own money. And so he would usually sell the money. And then
take about 30%.
Yeah, 30, sometimes up to 50% when it was really in demand. But, and, you know, he sold to organized crime groups, all these different mafias in Chicago. And then finally he decided, you know what, I'm going to keep doing that, but I'll print extra for myself. And he and his Moor and very often friends and family would go on these road trips where they would hit America's shopping malls. And three or four people would take, you know, spending Art's $100 bills, buying things for $10, getting $90 back in real currency. Within a couple hours, they could pull $4,000 or $5,000 out of a mall. And there are just so many malls in America. And they would just go on down the highway. Art would never spend him. He wouldn't spend himself. He'd direct the operation. And what's interesting is these trips became so fun for him and his girlfriend. And you're referring to the spirituality of it. It was they both would, you know, their eyes would sort of glaze over when they described these trips as pure freedom. They didn't have to worry about any. They'd hit them all on a weekend.
You think they'd worry about the police, but.
His money was so good at that point that it always passed. And they never wondered or worried whether or not it's going to pass, except in the southern climes, which I talk about in the book.
Yeah, you do.
And then another thing they really liked was after they have this, you know, trunk full of goods that they've just taken out of a mall, they would go to the Salvation Army.
Just give away stuff.
And just give away everything. And they didn't have to pack. They didn't have to carry any supplies. They could just buy everything they wanted along the road and discard it. And
but that was like a spiritual high, charity and donations.
Yeah.
And I mean, they felt good about themselves for doing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the whole Robin Hood thing.
And then I don't want to spoil the plot of this, but there is a point where he at least tries to go straight and talks to G-Men. It's kind of funny because he gets so nervous. This is a guy who did all these crimes and never even showed much in the way of anxiety, but talking to G-Men about how to counterfeit and how to pass these things and everything gets him nervous as hell. And it's as if, I mean, the picture you give of him, it's as if he just can't avoid the highs. He can't avoid, you know, the rush that comes with being a criminal.
Counterfeiters have a recidivism rate higher than heroin addicts. It's one of the most addictive crimes out there. And Art, you know, I would ask him, like, well, why is it so addictive? And he said, if you've ever made your own money and you see that money coming off the press, you know, it's almost like a sexual rush. And it's so empowering. And it was so empowering for him, having grown up in just abject poverty, to suddenly being able to print his own $100 bills. I mean, he on one level kind of lost the distinction between his money and genuine currency. He would tell me that I liked my money better than real money. because I had made it with my hands and, you know, almost like a loving act of creation in a very twisted way.
This would make a great movie. I mean, I know you've been told that and I've probably been optioned at this point. But one thing I didn't get and I have to ask you about, and that is, as I say, you frame this in a father-son story, and I'm just going to titillate people with the plot here and not give things away. But to a great extent, he wants and is very hungry for his father's love, even though his father abandoned him. What I don't understand is how Art and his sister accepted their father back when the father had raped the sister.
Yeah, well, that was something the sister never told Art until fairly recently. And so he didn't really know about that.
But she, the sister, accepted the father too.
She did. She did. And I mean, that was – I was very surprised to learn that. And I think it was a case of something happening so when she was so young that – and then after he left, there was that emptiness. I'm sure she wouldn't be the first to forgive her father for something like that. His sister's got a big spirit and a big heart, and I think she – wanted to forgive her father. She wanted a father figure in her life. I think that's so important for everybody wants that, even if their father is an atrocious person.
Well, they call their father the S word. I can't say it on the air. And he indeed comes across that way. And Art gets all stimulated in wanting to reconnect with his father because of that schlocky movie with Sylvester Stallone about arm wrestling.
Over the top, which is just such an appropriate... Yeah, Art, you know, he was on the run from the Secret Service at that time, and he sees this, he's hiding, and he sees this movie, this, you know, schmarmy movie with Sylvester Stallone and his kid traveling across the country in a truck and trying to reunite, and, it, you know, it just hit Art in the heartstrings, and he says, well, Jesus, what happened to my father? What... He left when he was 12. They'd never heard a thing from him. They didn't know where he went. It was like he had vanished from the face of the earth. And, you know, by then, the internet's coming around, and Art's girlfriend goes on an internet site, and she says, you know what? I found him. I think I found him, and he's in Alaska. And
he's up there right near Sarah Palin, in fact.
Yeah.
We're talking to Jason Kirsten, and again, his new book is The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. This is transgenerational. His kid was doing some counterfeiting too, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, this is tragic. I mean, you know, Art's son, the son's mother is actually a Chicago police officer now, he was just arrested a week ago for counterfeiting.
Yeah, I have him in the book being drawn into that. And in fact, Art's brother is still in prison, I assume, too.
Yeah, his brother's in jail. But his brother was never, you know, I think he was caught with some money. He kept making it himself.
It's quite a story. And Jason Kirsten, again, the author. I'm going to open up the phone lines. Some of you may indeed have read the story in Rolling Stone or may have even read the book, and you might want to join our conversation. But also this whole nature of counterfeiting money. I mean, it's a fascinating history. The book gives us that as well as the story of Art Williams. And as I said, tells us all about the evolution of the Secret Service. If you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation, we certainly welcome your calls. And if you have questions or comments, please feel free to join us. Toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. So feel free to join the program. Again, that's toll-free from wherever you're listening to Forum or however on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. You can also send us an email, and our email address is forum@kqed.org. And again, Jason Kirsten is the author of Journal of the Dead, his new book, The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. He'll be at Book Passage in Corte of Madeira on Saturday at 7 o'clock. And he's with us for the rest of the hour, so if you have something you'd like to say, ask, join us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with journalist and author Jason Kirsten, whose new book is The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. And again, you can meet the author this Saturday at 7 o'clock at Book Passage in Corte of Madeira. That's almost home territory. Grew up in San Anselmo and now lives in New York City and spending the hour with us talking about the life of Art Williams and counterfeiting and, well, fascinating subject about how a guy who grew up in Chicago in really the roughest part, Bridgeport, one of the roughest parts of Chicago, became a criminal and a master counterfeiter at that. You don't usually find, I imagine, not to get into class issues here, but master counterfeiters, like you said, it's often passed on generation to generation. It's a craft that's learned. They don't necessarily come from, well, the slums, really, do they?
I don't know enough about where they all come from to say that, you know, definitively the best ones don't come from the slums. Very often they're printers. They begin as printers. And, you know, printers generally have another way of sustaining themselves. But yeah, in where art was growing up, in there's really quite a criminal culture in Bridgeport. You know, this is almost like a PhD what he's doing in that world.
What about, I want to go to our callers here, but the idea of identifying these bills, you know, you talk about that so, to some extent, particularly with the pen, and art's great triumph was being able to avoid the pen. But you see people often looking, holding a $100 bill up to a light, you know, crinkling it, thinking somehow they can detect if it's counterfeit.
Right. Well, when they do that, they're looking for the watermark and the security strip. And, you know, art was able to defeat all those things. The pen was really one of the first things when he set out to defeat the note. And that had nothing to do with the new design. Even the old money, they'd use the pen on. But so many people depended on that pen that once he was able to figure out a way to defeat it, he loved seeing it. He loved every time it came out. He said, I loved it when they whipped out that pen because I knew they were going to take my money right away.
Well, we'll take our calls right away. And let's go first to Joseph. Good morning.
Well, hi. Hey, fascinating show. Great story. I got a question for the author. Do you have a movie deal in place? Because I would love to see the film and the father and the son relationship there. And who would you see as who would you like to see acting in the film? Do you have any particular actors you'd like to see as the father and the son in the film?
Well, you want to do some casting here, Jason?
Let's see. Well, for Da Vinci, I'd love to see Harvey Keitel, I think, would make a great Da Vinci, sort of an old school crook showing the kid the ropes. There was some Hollywood interest a couple of months ago. You know, it changes every week. Hollywood changes the story every week.
But they do have the rights, don't they?
They do. The rights are at Paramount, but that's from the magazine article.
The Rolling Stone article.
Yeah, which was, you know, in 2005. And really, it's quite a limited picture compared to the book. And they really haven't done anything with it. And the rights are going to return to me in August. And
you know, the number of sales and properties that are bought in Hollywood that are made into movies is minuscule. I mean, most people don't realize. They sit on some great things for years and years and do nothing with them.
Yeah. I mean, not uncommon for a movie to take 15 years to make, even though the story has been great and everyone knew it would make a great movie. But
so who would you cast as Art? I mean, he's got maybe Paul Newman blue eyes, but
right. Actually, there was some interest I heard through the Hollywood grapevine that Chris Pine, who plays the young Captain Kirk in the latest Star Trek, was interested. And when I saw him in that movie, I thought, boy, he really does look like Art at about 26 years old. And has kind of a swagger and the smile. I thought that he could do a convincing Art.
Art was born in 72, so that makes him about 37 now.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Let me get some more callers on here. And we go to Arno. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. My question is, how does one actually get started in this? The equipment is extremely expensive.
You aren't talking about this perhaps for a future vocation, are you, Arno?
No. Okay. No, but it's the fundamental question because it's so expensive. Are there criminal gangs to sort of specialize in, like, supplying this stuff? Or was the stuff stolen? Did his mentor give him the equipment? The final question is, was he ever asked by the feds to cooperate, and did he turn them down?
Okay, I think we've got enough questions there for the time.
Yeah, it's a great question. And starting out on your own as a counterfeiter is not an easy task because the equipment is expensive. Art really enjoyed the benefit of being in a region, an area where really the largest printing industry in the world is in Chicago and within a 200-mile radius. So there were tons of used presses. When he first started, he was an offsetter, where he's old school counterfeiting techniques that Da Vinci had taught him, using an offset press, burning plates, learning photolithographic process is what it's called, where you know you're shooting negatives of the bill, making your plates out of them, and then sticking that into a roller press, mixing your inks, kind of like in the beginning of the movie To Live and Die in L.A., which has a nice brief picture of what that was like. Mm-hmm. So he started out getting an old press and sort of assembling this equipment, and you know, he was doing other crimes to raise the money to set up his own shop. And you know, the shop's another thing you got to wrangle, because counterfeiting equipment can be kind of noisy sometimes, especially if you're running an offset, and you know, you need a dungeon essentially. And so it was quite hard to wrangle, and there were times when Art would swear that I'm going to quit, and he would destroy some of the presses that
he had to at one point, because the Secret Service.
Yeah, yeah. If he caught wind that you know somebody was on to him, you know, he'd have to ruin everything, hide everything, you know, you asked if he ever had stolen equipment. He did. There's a very nice convention center in Chicago called McCormick Place, where they have the largest printers convention every year. And all the guys from McCormick who work at McCormick Place are from Bridgeport. And so one of Art's buddies brings him in with a false ID, and Art gets to tour the whole floor and handpick which press he wanted. And so he picked a really nice Ryobi press that was worth about $14,000. This was later on. So he had help from friends wrangling equipment, too.
And friends fronted him money, too, I mean, on a number of occasions. Some of the mob people that he knew and people who were involved in the underworld. A listener's question here, and you kind of allude to some phony money in other countries. Bruce wants to know, he says, I've heard that North Korea has printed large amounts of U.S. dollars. Is this true? And if so, how much have they made?
Yeah, this appears to be absolutely true. The number I've heard in the $100 bills that they print has a name. It's called the supernote. And it is virtually indetectable from genuine currency because it's printed on what's called an intaglio press, which is a very high-end printing method that gives the feel of your genuine currency, that raised feel. And I took a tour of the lab, the Secret Service lab, and they showed me one of these bills, and I was just astounded because the only way you could tell was a little intentional mark on the bill on the Independence Hall tower. And the North – now, I asked them. I said, I'd heard that this was from North Korea. I said, so this is what the North Koreans are doing, and – the spokeswoman, she looked at me and she says, you're not allowed to attribute that to us. And over the years, there's been this sort of game because of the six-party talks where we don't actually outright accuse them of making this money, even though everyone knows it's coming from there. But just a month ago, there was a story in the Washington Times where the State Department came out and said, we know the name of the general who's making these. We know where he's making these. And this is because of all the problems with North Korea lately. So that's ratcheting up. But it's very bizarre. You know, Art Williams goes to prison for counterfeiting, and here we pretend that we don't know about the North Koreans doing the same thing.
Well, it is bizarre. You mentioned To Live and Die in L.A. There's another caller who wanted to mention or ask about Mr. 880 with Burt Lancaster.
Oh, right. Yeah, the old film. Yeah, I never actually saw that film. So, I was told that it's about a guy who did $1 bills and very good ones. But that's – since I never saw it, I can't really comment on it.
Here's another listener joining us from Pismo Beach. Drew, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. You know, I used to be in the printing business. I ran a six-color Heidelberg press, and I was both in the printing process, running the actual press, and then I also did a lot of lithograph. I spent 2 years in the lithograph. I know all about, you know, burning plates, stuff like that. And it occurred to me more than a few times that, you know, you're a hop, skip, and a jump away from doing this on your own. But my particular question is, where did he get the paper? Because, as somebody who's got a background in printing, I could cover the printing process. But unless you had contacts in the paper business, it seems to me it would be pretty hard to come up with the raw material on that end.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And that was one of Art's specialties.
Well, his ingenuity, yeah.
Was getting the paper. Yeah. And when he did the 1996 new note, he was really looking for a paper that was acid-free, starch-free, so that it wouldn't react with the pen. And he called in samples from tons of paper companies, had them sent to a post office box and fake name and all that. And this went on for weeks as he and his wife were trying to find the right paper to do the new note. And finally, out of frustration, his wife just started marking everything in the house, saying, "Look, Art, nothing's working. What do you want me to do?" And she ran the pen across a phone book, and found that not the yellow pages, but the white pages of the phone book, actually it marked perfect. And Art says, "Jesus, who makes this? Who prints this phone book?" And eventually he finds a company called Abitibi Consolidated, and it's one of the largest printers in the world. And he calls them and wants
to
order.
Funny story, yeah.
He "Can you get me some of this?" And he says, "We supply the amounts used for cities, not guys." And so, but he eventually finds a local printing house that's using this directory paper, and he goes there posing as a Sunday school teacher, and saying that he's working on a project for the school, and they would be willing to donate some paper for the project. And he asked specifically for what's called a butt roll, and that's the caller would know what this is. That's the remainder left over from these huge presses, industrial presses, that just goes in the recycling bin, almost like the last piece on a roll of toilet paper. But in this case, it's hundreds of pounds, and so he gets them to donate him a butt roll, and he can that's worth millions of dollars to him. He can use that to print money, because the paper won't mark. And his bills actually are two sheets of paper, and he slips in the watermark and the security strip almost like a sandwich. And it's very thin, so that it was really kind of quite extraordinary. And he would use the paper scamming thing even before he did the new note. He would go to printing houses in Chicago and ask for butt rolls, always posing as a student or a teacher, and then, walking away with a couple hundred pounds of it.
You got a picture of a grifter, a con man, a criminal, in so many different ways and so many different manifestations, but also someone who had kind of a street ethic, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, part of it was loyalty, for example. Yeah,
yeah, he never ratted out anybody. There was definitely a code that he had. And that was, you don't rat on anyone. That's really the center of his code. But revenge is part of it. And if someone betrays you, you get him.
There's a guy in the construction business that he worked for example. That's quite a story. We'll just maybe tease people with that. Let me go to more calls in the meantime. John, you're on. Hi.
Hi, Michael. First of all, I love your programming. You're thoroughly a delight to listen to every morning. I had an interesting story on counterfeiting that I've enjoyed telling over the years that I heard on Paul Harvey. So, of course, I assume it has to be true, but perhaps the
author... Well, it's out of Chicago.
Perhaps the author can verify whether he's heard the same story. It involved a counterfeiter, and I believe it was in America, and he was counterfeiting $100 bills. And he was very successful at it. And to test his mettle, he decided to take one of his own bills to a bank. And he proceeded to tell them, "Would you mind testing this for me? I have a feeling I took in a counterfeit bill." And they ran it through whatever rigor they needed to run it through. And they said, "No, this is perfectly fine." And so the secret to his success was apparently he was bleaching $1 bills and then printing over them a $100 bill. And the close, as Paul Harvey is so apt to do, was apparently the guy got caught because he was kiting checks for something like $50. I just found that to be a really entertaining story.
You know the story, Jason?
I've never heard the story. I'm very familiar with bleaching, which was actually Art sort of frowned on that. Bleaching is a technique that counterfeiters use where, in order to use genuine currency paper, they'll just bleach out like a $1 or a $5 bill and then reprinted in a higher denomination.
That to him was old school, bad old school, yeah?
Yeah, to him it was cheating. But and also, that's one of the reasons why you have a watermark in the higher denominations is you can change the face of the bill, but you can't change what's inside of it. And Art wanted a bill that would pass all those tests. Now, as far as going to a bank, that bank certainly didn't know much about genuine currency if they said this is perfectly fine. I don't know what tests they would have performed on it, but... just by the feel of the bill, a bleach bill is going to be a very flat bill. And they're going to know right away that anyone who knows the feel of genuine currency is going to know right away it's not genuine. And I don't know what year this story was supposed to take place, but if they held that bill in front of a transmitted light source, that bill would not have contained a watermark or a security strip. If it was a $1 bleach bill, they could have known right just by that that it was not genuine currency. And unless they used magnetic ink, if they ran it through their counting machine, that would have been a giveaway too.
You know, you're struck when you read your book by the resourcefulness and ingenuity, as we said before, of Art Williams, and one wonders what he could have been, you know, if he had gone and lived a straight life. I'm sure he's thought about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's he's got such a creative mind and a great imagination.
And talent.
Yeah, and talent. I think that if he hadn't gone down that criminal road, he could have been a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. It's really, that's the sadness of the saddest thing in his life is the judge who sentenced him on his most recent conviction, you know, said he was very saddened by it because he knew how you know, good Art's money was and the story of Art's childhood. And, you know, he said, this is just really sad. There's no reason you couldn't be making good money in legitimate business, but here we are.
If you'd like to join us at the time remaining with Jason Kirsten, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. And we go to Michael as our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning. Have you seen this movie that's out, the German movie, The Counterfeiter, about the Jewish counterfeiters in the concentration camps?
Yeah, that's a fantastic film.
Isn't that fascinating? I think you should pass it on. It is really a fascinating movie, and I just wanted to bring that up. Also, you know, as a young man, I was associated with a mafia guy for a while in my life, and he was a totally fascinating human being, and he was so talented in so many ways, but he was just a crook.
Well, some of those in my youth as well.
It comes down to that, ultimately.
Yeah.
But
thanks.
Anyway, the movie's wonderful and fascinating show. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for the call. And on we go to more of your calls. Alexi, joining us from Berkeley. Morning.
Hi, thank you. My question is about the security strip. How does such a thing work, and how would you go about reproducing such a thing? It sounds like kind of a high-tech sort of thing.
Yeah, the security strip, which actually started out in 89, it's a polyurethane strip. And you can print on polyurethane, and that's exactly what Art did. Now, if you really look closely to strip at that bill there, it's hard to read what he's got printed on the strip. But the lettering on the strip is so small that people really don't look to read the lettering. And so he would, as long as the strip was there, as long as it had the illusion of being printed on. He didn't have to get the super fine line printing that comes on genuine currency, but he would also use ultraviolet ink, which is also something you can buy, so that when people held a black light over the bill, which is another feature of the strip, it'll glow in different colors depending on the denomination. And on the 100, it's kind of a red-orange. And so his bill would glow underneath the ultraviolet light, too. As he told me, he wanted a bill that would pass every test.
This bill that I'm looking at that you brought in here is marked counterfeit on both sides, just in case.
I did that. Made that. I stamped that myself because, you never know with the Secret Service. And
Sean joins us from Buffalo. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Some of these calls seem suspicious to me, but if I came across, like, let's say a suitcase with full of these $100 bills, what value, like if I wanted to fence them, what value per bill, pennies on the dollar,
exactly. If they're really good, if they're as good as the best bills Art ever made, you know, he was able to get 50 cents on the dollar. But generally, 30 cents on the dollar is considered a really good rate. If they're very very crappy bills, then you know maybe you could get a dime on the dollar.
Do you know of any other master American counterfeiters of his? Use the word stature here, for lack of a better word, or of his accomplishments.
Currently operating, I don't, but Art would always tell me, well, I'm not the best counterfeiter out there, Jason. He would say the best is the guy nobody knows about who's didn't blow it, who didn't get too greedy.
He's totally under the radar.
Who's quietly doing it and he's off the radar. And, you know, he was very adamant about that. I can't call myself the best because you don't know who the best is. People pop up from time to time, but...
Well, he was better than Da Vinci, his mentor, wasn't he?
Yeah, with the new note, and the techniques he used for the new note was a combination of digital and old school offset. His bill was unusual. It was called a hybrid bill, is how the Secret Service would refer to it, because he's using both technologies. But as far as any others out there, I don't know about that. And law enforcement people I did interview for this book said they had never encountered anyone with counterfeit currency as good as his.
Fred joins us next. Fred, you're on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm reading the book. I'm halfway or about a third of the way through it. And what impresses me is this guy's background was so amazingly bleak, so beyond Dickensian, that it's amazing the guy rose to do anything other than be a low-level street thug.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that really says a lot. The fact that he's a felon, a counterfeiter, but given his background, when you read the book and you see just the horror of his childhood, which pretty much almost killed his sister. She's almost like another side of him. I think she internalized all the anger that happened in their childhood, and I think he externalized it.
Well, there's so much trauma and horror. I mean, in this story, I'm just thinking about, you know, you mentioned the mother being mentally ill, but also the mother gets into a row with the sister who hits her over the head with a beer bottle and causes permanent damage.
Set off the schizophrenia. She had a mental problem before that, but anyway, yeah, this was Art's aunt gets in a fight with his mother and hits the mom over the head with a beer bottle, and Art witnessed this.
Yeah.
He witnessed this.
Well, we thank you for the call, Fred, and let me move on and get Michael in here next. Michael, hi.
Hi, good morning, guys. What a fantastic topic. Actually, wanted to share a tragic and ironic tale from my own middle school. I went to school, played soccer with a kid who eventually became an employee of Kinko's, and this is local, actually, and I'm not going to say the name, obviously, but got pretty good at using the equipment there at night, and I eventually was convicted of a felony himself, but was making, I think, $200,000 to $300,000 at the time, just here in the Bay Area, using Kinko's own supplies. But my question is regarding the monochromatic nature of the U.S. dollar. I had heard from, you know, slightly dubious sources that the U.S. bill was intentionally monochromatic for years to make it actually easy to counterfeit, or relatively easy compared to European currency, and then hence spread more dollars around the world, be they fake or not. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I'd actually never heard that, and I'd be very surprised if it's true, because the stupidest thing a government can do is devalue its own currency. The rationale for the United States currency taking a while to get up to speed with some of the other like European currencies, they had more anti-counterfeiting measures in their bills for a long time prior to us doing the 96 note, and even now, just adding color. Just a few years ago, we started adding color to the bills. And the explanation for that is generally that they didn't want to mess with the distinctiveness of the dollar. The dollar was the most valued currency on the planet, and the Treasury Department was always very worried about changing it. And they were so conservative. It's the greenback. It's the almighty dollar. Let's not mess with it too much, because if we do, people won't trust it. And indeed, in 96, when the currency changed over, some people didn't trust the change, even though it was more secure. Some people wouldn't take
it. It looked like funny money to a lot of people.
Yeah, they called it monopoly money, yeah, and all this stuff. But sooner they had to bite that bullet because, the kids at Kinko's were getting out of control, essentially, like the caller was referring to. There's lots of teenage counterfeiters out there that will just, you know, print up some 20s and, you know, go blow it at McDonald's or something like that, or on some music. And this was becoming so prolific that they really had to redesign the money, because the Secret Service just spends far too much time chasing down teenagers. And that to this day, it's still a problem. I mean, you're talking about the world's most elite law enforcement agency chasing kids.
Well, you know, last week I was in Prague, and the money there really does look like funny money and monopoly money, you know, thousands and this sort of thing. I mean, they're using the euro as well, but I'm talking about the Czech money that's printed in the Czech Republic. And you wonder how easy that is to counterfeit compared to, say, American money. It would seem to be, just on the face of it, a lot easier.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to sort of take a look at it. I know that we've taken a lot of our cues from foreign currency, though. You know, putting the watermark in there was something that, you know, the British were doing with the pound for a long, long time. That's even old world technology. But a lot of the changes to our money, we were just copying what other countries were doing. Even though the money looks silly to us, remember, it's not our money. You know, so on one level, all money looks silly to us.
Tamara, we'll get you on. Good morning. Tamira, are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm listening to your show, fascinated, because I grew up in a working-class household, and I used to dream of being a counterfeiter because we never had enough money. So I have two questions. One is, are there any famous or important women counterfeiters? And the other question is, you filled out a really complete picture of him, the counterfeiter, as a businessman, but could you talk a little more about his spiritual and his intellectual life? Did he have any religious convictions? And did he have a social philosophy that kind of enabled him to forgive himself for what he was doing? Because he must, being so smart, he must have understood the destructive implications for society of being a counterfeiter.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are great questions. And to go for your first one about female counterfeiters, I don't know anything in modern history. I know there was a very famous case in pre-colonial times of a woman who was counterfeiting, the British money that we spent when we were still a colony, and she was making her own stone plates. In her house, and I think she was eventually hung. Back in those days, they would hang counterfeiters. As far as arts,
it was a capital crime for a long time.
Yeah, and in some countries it still is.
Yeah.
As far as arts, spirituality and his criminal rationality, he was definitely raised a churchgoer, and he sort of fell away from that. But that's very important to him. I would say that, he considers himself a Christian in terms of his upbringing. And he will talk about God. And one of the things he says in the book is that he believes that God wants us to play. And that's what they were doing when they were going around the country and passing the money at the malls. Part of his ethos was, we never hit mom and pop stores. Because he knew that it could be destructive, seeding $100 bills into people's income. So he would always go for the big national
chains. Yeah.
That made it okay, but it was part of his
rationale.
Like I said,
he had an ethic. We've come to the end of the hour. It's a fascinating read. Jason, thanks for being with us. Good luck with the book, Jason Kirsten. The Art of Making Money, The Story of a Master Counterfeiter. He'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 7 o'clock this Saturday. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Kevin Guillory and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Howie Gelman. And Judy Campbell is back, and I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.